My goodness, the cicadas are coming. Call of the cicadas there to get us started today. And you're going to be hearing a lot of that sound, I think, in the coming months. We'll find out how much as we visit with our guest today, PJ Leash. Good to have him back in the studio with me. He's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he's going to talk about cicadas. There's a citizen science project that relates to it. I looked online to check it out. It looks like a really cool thing. You'll be able to participate in that. And, of course, if you had other questions relating to insects, or maybe you've got a photo of an insect you want to have us take a look at and try and identify, or at least not me, PJ will do it, you can do that as well. How do you do that? Well, you can email your photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org, or if you just have a question or maybe an experience to share relating to insects, maybe even cicadas, give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. PJ Leash, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Larry.
Great to have you. And cicadas are they're going to have a big year. What's going to happen in the next few months?
Yeah, so what we are going to be experiencing is something truly unique, and this is really an amazing natural phenomenon. And we just had a little bit of this because we had that solar eclipse a week ago, and it drew so many folks together outside of all backgrounds viewing the solar eclipse. The periodical cicadas are going to be somewhat similar. And the way I think about it, because these emerge in Wisconsin once every 17 years— if you live in the state your entire life, you might only get a handful of opportunities to ever see these. I will admit, I turned 40 next year. I have never seen them myself with my own eyes. I've seen specimens. I've got some in the lab. But I'm going to make sure to head down to some of the hot spots to see them myself this year and just experience it.
So the hot spots... where? Indiana, in that area?
Well, we do have a few hot spots here in the state. And... if you look at the news articles, there's a lot of maps going around out there, but some of the maps, they have some caveats associated with them. Some of the counties shaded in, like Milwaukee County, for example, historically we have had cicada records there of these insects, but really haven't been spotted in decades there. So what I did this last winter is I dug through about 150 years of old newspaper articles, government publications, books, this and that, to figure out our best idea of where they occur in the state. And I compiled that as a map on a new periodical cicada website for Wisconsin. We do know there's some hot spots. The single best place that comes up again and again, even going back to newspapers, 1800s, Lake Geneva area down in Walworth County.
All right.
If you head there in probably first, second week of June, they should be calling at that point, and it's going to be a neat experience. There's also some activity near Janesville area in Beloit, and then as you go along the Wisconsin River, Spring Green and some of the other towns along there, they've been spotted as well, all the way to Prairie du Chien and then towards the Dubuque, Iowa area.
You know, I'm thinking back 17 years, and I'm certainly on the air 17 years ago, and I don't recall it being a big deal in the Madison area.
Right. And I've been getting a lot of questions from homeowners worried about their trees because cicadas can technically cause a little bit of damage to trees. The thing is, for Madison, is we haven't had any specimens verified or reports verified for decades. Yeah. And with these insects, they really don't move all that much. And so that's something I've been telling folks. If they are wondering if they will see them in their own yard or neighborhood, ask yourself, did you live in that same spot in 2007? If you did, and you did not see them in 07, you're almost certainly not going to see them this year because they're just not going to spontaneously appear. These insects, they lay eggs, they're associated with trees, they feed on tree roots. And so if the trees over time are cut down for agriculture fields, for parking lots, for apartment buildings or homes.
Maybe an old one in your backyard. Right. That happened to me.
But if these trees are cut down, the habitat of these insects is probably being lost over time. So we haven't had any reports in Madison itself in decades. I know of some activity out towards Mazamania in Dane County. And then a couple years ago, occasionally some of these cicadas will pop out of cycle about four mm-hmm. years early. And I had a confirmed report from Deerfield area. So I really don't know what the population is in Deerfield. I'd be curious if anyone in that part of the state keeps an eye out and could share reports. But otherwise, if you want to see them, you probably need to drive down to Janesville or Lake Geneva area would be some of your best bets.
Jim and Stephen's Point has something relating to this. So let's go there. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm traveling down to Northwest Chicago around June 10th to see my new granddaughter. And my daughter is crazed about the cicada bloom and says it's going to be way too loud and there's going to be dead cicadas, everything all over the place. I'm just curious what it's going to be like to be in the middle of them at that time.
Yeah, so we do know that there is a strong population in some of the Chicago suburbs. And as a whole, Northern Illinois is going to see more cicadas than we will. So, of course, Lake Geneva and Janesville, some of the spots in the state will have lots of them. But overall, the Chicago area is going to see more than we will. If you are in a hot spot, the first thing you may notice when they emerge is simply the holes in the ground that they come out of. And a key trigger for emergence is the soil temperature has to warm up to about 64 degrees at a depth of 8 inches. We know that from some research.
Okay.
And then what also helps is maybe a decent rain right around that same time. That'll cause them to emerge. For Chicago area, they're probably going to pop out, I would suspect, maybe around third week of May or thereabouts. In Wisconsin, we're probably a little bit behind late May, early June. But if you're in a spot that has lots and lots of them, they are going to be loud. They're going to be everywhere, on sidewalks, on trees. They're pretty clumsy as adults, so they may accidentally fly into you. They don't live very long, so eventually they will die after about a month, and they're going to decompose, and it's essentially free fertilizer, but it might not smell the most pleasant if you're in a hot spot. But while they're active and calling, that's the males singing to attract females, it is going to be quite loud. If they are in a clump of trees a ways away from you, it might be in the range of about 80-ish decibels, similar to a vacuum cleaner. But if you have them in your yard, it can easily be in that 90 to 100 decibel range, which is like being next to a really, really busy highway.
Oh, man. Jim, thank you very, very much. Well, here we got somebody with an on-site report, I believe. Jim in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I was a ranger there at the Bigfoot Beach State Park for 15 years and seasons. And the cicadas, whenever they came in the campground at night, which is about a half a mile up from the entrance, it's just like you can't even talk hardly. They're that thick. And they're every place you step, they're all over the place in the campground. And then the rest, because that's old hardwood. And then the rest of the park, and it's only about 150 acres of park where you can drive, so it's a small park, but it's just wild, the noise they make, especially at night, all night long, those things, you just drive you nuts.
So, you know, I guess you could camp and experience it, but Jim, did you get a lot of complaints from people?
Oh yeah, I retired many years ago, but in the times that I were there, it was like havoc. It was they are so loud, and there are so many of them. They're coming out of every nook and cranny. I believe they come out of the ground too occasionally, yeah, by trees. They like to get under the roots, and the little buggers are just all over the place. And then when they finally die, it takes a couple of days, and then they're just dead cicadas everywhere.
Jim, thanks for that report. That sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if you are in one of the hot spots, and I know Bigfoot Beach State Park has come up in some of the records, so I know there's a lot in there, and also just kind of the general North Shore, Lake Geneva seems to be a good spot for these, but it, as Jim had mentioned, it's going to be very, very loud, to the point that, you know, folks, if they have outdoor activities they're trying to plan, graduation parties, wedding ceremonies, things like that, you probably either need to relocate those indoors or look for another venue. You know, it could even be 10 minutes down the road where they don't have the cicadas, it'd be a lot quieter. But if you're in a hot spot, it's going to be very, very loud.
And, you know, these cicadas, they're looking for sex, aren't they?
In a nutshell, yes.
That's what it's all about?
Right. I mean, so they spend over 95% of their entire life underground. They are feeding on tree roots for 17 years, and then they get to come out for about a month. And that's really the only thing on their mind is trying to find a mate. That's why there's so much noise. That's the males singing to attract females. And they'll often congregate in trees or a specific area called a chorusing center, and they make a lot of noise. Females will come in. If they get close enough, the female can't respond back by singing, but she can flick her wings, and it makes almost a snapping noise. And they mate, lay eggs. The female will actually take a structure called an ovipositor. It looks like a spear under the microscope. And she'll cut into twigs on trees, and that does cause a little bit of damage. And then she's going to insert batches of eggs, and she can lay maybe upwards of 500 eggs total in her lifetime, which isn't very long as an adult.
That's you wonder how they find each other, though. I mean, amidst all of the, how do you find the right one?
Right. Yeah, you got all this noise going on. It's kind of dark in the evening, too. I mean, they do have very large, prominent eyes. And then at close ranges, the female responding back, they'll be able to get closer and closer.
Yeah, the eyes are, they're kind of red, aren't they? Or is that the maroon almost?
Yeah, usually a very vibrant red color. And that's an really easy way to tell them apart from our kind of run-of-the-mill cicadas that we see every year. And those ones we call our dog day cicadas because they're mostly out during the hot dog days of summer, July, August, September. And our dog day cicadas are more of a black and olive green color. Mm-hmm. But these ones, the periodical cicadas, have distinctive red eyes. And their bodies are black with some orange on the legs and the wings.
We're going to take another call. This time we'll go to Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm looking at this as a perfect opportunity to get buckets full of fantastic organic fertilizer. However, I just thought if I dumped all those in my garden, being that it'll be a mix of male and females, am I going to be inoculating my garden for a future disaster, or won't they reproduce in that form?
Okay.
Good question. If you were to take these and put them in your garden, you're really not moving eggs from them. When they go to lay eggs, the females are inserting these into twigs on trees. And then once the eggs are in the twigs, they're going to sit there for about maybe 6 weeks or so, about a month and a half-ish, maybe even 2 months, before they hatch. At that point, the young juveniles drop to the ground, go into the soil, and then they're looking for tree roots to feed on. So in something like a vegetable garden, even if you had eggs in theory and juveniles, they probably aren't going to have the food supply that they're looking for. So in this case, I don't think you're going to be introducing any eggs into your garden.
There you go. Thanks, Thomas, for calling. Appreciate your call. PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest today. We're talking cicadas right now, but I know Jim in Grandview has a different kind of question, and you might have one too. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us your question, or if you have an insect photo you want to have PJ take a look at, you can do that as well. Go to ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Robbins, our technical director today, along with Tyler Ditter and Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking insects on the program today, zeroed in a bit on cicadas, but taking other questions as well. The number 800-642-1234. Email your question or your photo to ideas@wpr.org. And PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, is here to take your questions. Larry in Brookfield will give you a shot. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I have just planted some young berries and fruit trees, and I'm in Whitewater. Do you think a light row cover is enough to put over them to protect them from the cicadas?
Good question, and that does bring up an interesting point. I mentioned a couple minutes ago that the cicadas, when they go to lay eggs, the females cut slits into woody plants, trees, shrubs, even woody vines like grapevines, for example, can be harmed by these. So the damage caused by them isn't by feeding, it's by the egg-laying activity. A couple thoughts here. If you were in your same house back in 2007, I would simply ask yourself, did you see these insects last time? Because if you didn't, you're almost certainly not going to see them this time. And if that's the case, you don't have to worry about them at all. If you did see them in your yard last time, well, then we can take some precautions for plants like this. And you did hit the nail on the head, Larry, with the suggestion about row cover. We can use mesh netting to physically cover plants. That will prevent the cicadas from getting to them. If they can't get to them, they can't damage the trees at all. A couple factors, though. The mesh netting needs to be fine enough. If you have a mesh size that might be big enough for, say, birds, like a 1-inch mesh, that's not going to work. The cicadas might still fit through or damage plants. But if you have a fine mesh that's, say, under half an inch or so, quarter inch, something like that, that's going to be fine enough to prevent the cicadas from getting to the plants and prevent damage. But again, the question I'd have is it really necessary? Personally, I have not seen any confirmed reports from Whitewater itself. So I'd really ask yourself, if you live there in 07, did you see them or did neighbors see them? Because if you didn't, you probably have no need to worry at all.
There you go, Larry. Thank you so much for calling. Nettie and Dousman, what's on your mind?
Well, I lived in the tropics for a while, and I wanted to know about cicadas in other parts of the world.
Sure.
And it seems to me they were particularly large, and they're in the tropics, and I think they were even eating them. Is that a possibility?
They were eating them.
Yeah, well, both of those can definitely be true. Worldwide, there's over 3,000 or so species of cicadas, and so there's a lot of variation in size and coloration. The body shape is generally going to be the same for most cicadas out there, but size and color can differ, and also the songs or sound they produce could differ as well. There are some very large species down in tropical areas, and yes, cicadas, they are edible, and so in some cultures around the world, they may be a somewhat regular part of human diet. Here in the U.S., if you look back in historical records, Native Americans and settlers would sometimes eat these because they were simply a very readily available and abundant protein source to come out in such numbers. If you hop online and search on Google or another site, look for like cicada recipes. There's recipe books out there about these, and you know, some of them you might read the recipe and say, that's pretty interesting. And I've seen some recipes that I've said, you know, that sounds like a pretty tasty appetizer when you think about it.
Dennis had emailed to say that Zorba, a pastor on his show, said people get vitamin B12 from insects that are mixed in, insect bits that are mixed in with canned vegetables, which is true, I'm sure, I believe. He's wondering if you can can these cicadas.
That's a good question. So I have not thought of that myself in terms of doing some home canning of these. As I just mentioned, though, at other parts of the planet, folks do eat cicadas and other insects as a regular part of their diet. Here in the U.S., folks can, you know, indeed collect and eat some of these if they want. I just don't know how they would turn out with a canning process, though. I would probably have to spend some time, or any listeners could spend some time kind of searching online and see if there's any recipes out there or procedure for canning them. I just have not heard of that myself, but insects as a whole can be pretty nutritious in terms of high protein content, good fats, some vitamins and minerals in there, too.
Jim in Grandview will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. I got a question. I'm not sure I want to know the answer, but I have acres of wildflowers around my house, It's quite beautiful, and I've been bringing lupin seeds out of road ditches back and throwing either side of the lane for probably the last 20 years. Well, I've got thousands and thousands of lupins at the end of June. But a few years ago, an insect started, I noticed, started eating the blossoms off, and so you'd get a spike of no flowers and just the plant. But anyway, the insect, I found out the hard way, is a blister beetle. An inch-long, beautiful black beetle with red-tipped feet. Well, this is my question. I know blister beetles attack insect eggs. And is this blister beetle attacking bee eggs, my nests of bees around the place?
Maybe.
Yeah, that's a good answer, Larry. Maybe. It depends on the species of blister beetle. And when you were describing it, when I heard about the lupins and something eating the flowers, I was already thinking of blister beetles before you even mentioned it. Blister beetles, as adults, they have an unusual pattern, and I do see these on a somewhat regular basis, not too many cases in a year, but the pattern with them seems to be that the adults show up out of the blue. They will nibble on flowers, especially of plants from the legume family, so peas and lupins and things like that. Even some of the types of locust trees, for example, can be nibbled on to a certain extent. They don't really seem to cause that much overall damage other than they really like to feed on the flowers. So from an aesthetic standpoint, that can be an issue. But there's a lot of different species of blister beetles. Some specifically feed on the eggs of grasshoppers. Other species are associated with solitary ground nesting bees. And so in this case, I'd almost have to see a photo or a sample of the beetles to let you know what type it is, so that I could tell you what sort of life cycle it has, if it's associated with grasshoppers or solitary bees.
Probably wouldn't be too hard for Jim to get a sample from the sound of it.
Oh, right. Yeah, if they show up in abundance, again, they're usually not there very long, but you could easily grab a sample, send it into the insect diagnostic lab. I would just caution, if you do that, you know, you don't want to crush them on your skin because of the defensive chemical they have can cause blisters. So maybe wear a pair of latex gloves or something like that, or grab them with a Ziploc bag turned inside out and zip that up.
And send it off to you. And if you go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, type that in, you're going to get the address and all the information you need. There you go, Jim. Thank you. Blanche in Surrey.
Good morning. I just have a story about living in Hoffman Estates or the Schaumburg area outside of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the 70s when the cicada came that particular year, and we didn't have them in our housing development. It had been, the ground had been leveled, and those houses were built in the 60s. So because they leveled it, as they did back in those days with housing developments, the cicadas were dug up. So when we would go into the city or we'd visit somebody else, in another, you know, we went to we went to the south a little bit, and the noise was deafening, and we couldn't believe that we didn't have them. We didn't understand why we were having and didn't have them. Actually, during that time, the rumor, and it might still be, that they would take the tinfoil and wrap it around the tree up to about 6 feet, thinking that the cicadas would not climb up on that tinfoil and that would prevent it. Except there were so many trees and there were so many cicadas that there was no solving with that, I don't think. Maybe it worked. But I just remember we had moved from California, and I think it was the year after we arrived there when the cicadas came. And we were just like appalled.
Well, Blanche, that's a great story. I love it. And it does go along with what you were saying, that you need those trees. They didn't have trees, so they didn't have cicadas.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why when you look at where these things have occurred historically, it's generally going to be wooded areas. Sometimes humans had changed the land to a certain extent, but it could still be good habitat, like an orchard setting with fruit trees, because you have all these trees out in the open, a lot of sun. Cicadas can really like that. But again, if you have a spot that is good cicada habitat and you cut those trees down, the cicadas, not only do they need trees, they need those trees to be present for long periods of time.
Yeah.
So you cut those trees down, the cicadas die because that was their food source. They were feeding on sap from the roots. And so that would basically cause them to go extinct in that little localized area.
Blanche, thank you so much for that story. Appreciate it very much. Harry in Hayward, we'll go to you. Hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning. I lived, I'm retired here in Hayward now, but I lived in a suburb of Chicago, Downers Grove, for many years, and they had large oak savannas there. And I would walk with the dog, and those cicadas on the ground, and at the time there was this, you could have a chocolate dip cicadas and all that other stuff. And I picked up, and I ate two of them. And it felt like a tree bark. It was dry, and it was chewy like a piece of candy, and without the sweetness of the chocolate. So they're edible, and they were pretty good. So there you go.
Thanks, Harry. So he liked them. But yeah, you can get them chocolate-covered, which to me would be more palatable.
I've heard of the chocolate-covered ones. A lot of the recipes that I've looked at, there's usually quite a bit of seasoning involved, you know, various spices, garlic, pepper, things like that. But when you think of them, I mean, insects are really pretty closely related to some other creatures that we will pay a lot of money for. Lobsters, crabs, shrimp, yeah. They have that same hard exoskeleton. There's some fibrous components there. But it really is going to take on kind of the flavor of what you put on them as well.
Yeah, and Michael had emailed. He was wondering about resources for cooking with cicadas, drying, freezing, sushi, he wonders.
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier, but if you hop online and just search for like periodical cicada recipes, you should be able to find lots of things out there. I've seen plenty of recipes myself. I've even seen some little cookbooks worked up on our new cicada site. I think I maybe even mentioned a recipe book and shared a link on our FAQ page.
Ray in Whitefish Bay, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Switching to another insect, monarchs.
Yeah.
Several years ago, I started raising monarchs, and I use. So my question is seasonal variability of the hatching of the monarch eggs. So in brief, I have swamp milkweed. I collect the eggs, put them in a plastic container on damp paper towel, and what I find is the eggs in June, July, I have about 100% success rate, and I've sterilized the containers between groups. But come middle August and early September, the viability of the eggs decreases to like 40%, 30%. And the swamp milkweed provides, you know, there's fresh leaves coming up all the time. I was wondering if your expert had any ideas of why that would occur.
Yeah, a couple thoughts off the top of my head. Because monarchs are migrating up here, I mean, they fly down to Mexico, they spend the winter. That batch makes it up maybe into Texas, and so it takes a couple of successive generations to get all the way up to...
Yeah, I think it's three, isn't it?
Yeah, two or three. Depends on how the winds are as well. But that migratory pattern, to a certain extent, might cull the herd a little bit in terms of diseased monarchs. We know that can be the case as they fly all the way down to Mexico. If you are afflicted with some sort of parasite or disease, you know, that's going to weaken you, harder to make it up there. And so one thing I would wonder about is early in the season, perhaps there might be a lower load of diseases out there. And then later on in the season, there might be more diseases, more parasites and things like that. So I'm not sure if that's the case, but I could see that being a very feasible scenario.
Yeah. Carol from Merrill emailed us, do cicadas have predators, or are they digesting or disgusting to be food for a predator? They have plenty of predators.
Plenty of predators. And actually, you know, I've been getting a lot of questions. Are cicadas good or bad? Yeah, they make some noise. They injure trees a little bit, but big trees tolerate it just fine. Overall, though, I think a lot more of the benefits that these will provide, because when these cicadas come out by the millions and billions, it's going to be a free buffet for wildlife. Yeah, lots of birds. Things are going to feed up. Birds, exactly. Wide range of birds will feed on these. If cicadas are near a body of water and they fall in, which very easily can do because they're clumsy insects, fish, turtles, and other animals in the water. On land, a lot of mammals and other vertebrates can feed on these, skunks, raccoons, and so on. So for about a month while these are out, all the vertebrates that feed on them, they're just going to have a heck of a time. They won't have to work hard to get food. Now, overall, this actually might be part of a survival strategy. And the idea with this is if you're an insect and you emerge in low numbers and you're making a lot of noise, things may pick you off, and that's not a good strategy. But if you come out in such large numbers that there's enough of you that all the predators get a full belly, there's still plenty that can reproduce. And when they lay eggs, females can lay up to 500 eggs. So, you know, you're going to lose some that are being eaten, but plenty more will survive and reproduce, too.
Nature's pretty cool. It is. It is. Marianne in Pulaski, we'll go to you. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, Larry and guests. I have a question. I live out in the country. We had a well-established lawn, and I think we have a grub infestation because the last year or two, something is destroying my pristine lawn.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, so a couple thoughts. Given your location in Pulaski, one insect I wonder about, we have a newer white grub pest that has shown up in the state about the last decade or so called the European chafer. Initially, the most damage was in Door County area, but now I've been seeing a lot of that insect in basically the counties close to the border with Upper Michigan, and Michigan has a lot more of these than we do. I'm also seeing them pop out in some more southern locations around Lake Michigan. So it wouldn't surprise me if European chafers were involved. There's also in that kind of northeast quarter of the state, a long history with May-June beetles that can cause issues. There's also other species like Japanese beetles that are pushing their way northward. What I would recommend in a case like this is if you're able to do some digging now that it's warmed up enough, see if you can find some of these grubs. And the reason I'm saying that is it can be really helpful to know what species they are, because European chafers, Japanese beetles, they have one generation per year. But the May-June beetles, it takes 3 years for a generation, and you'll have overlapping generations, meaning different grub sizes. So that type of grub is a lot harder to control, and we might have to do some different things. So if you can get some grubs to me, I can tell you the exact type, and that can help us fine-tune some management approaches. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, for Japanese beetles, European chafers, we generally want to try, what gives you the best results would be to try a preventative grub treatment, which would be applied to your lawn around the time that the adults are out and laying eggs. And that can work very well against controlling some of the small grubs. But if you have big grubs, those are much harder to control. So knowing the grub species can help with the timing and help inform what sorts of products to use.
There you go, Marianne. Thank you so much for calling. And again, go to UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Go online. You'll get the information on how to send that material in. Kate in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. I appreciate the timeliness of this program for my short story and question. Sunday night, I was in outside of Nashville, Tennessee. It was nighttime and with family, and they had me put a flashlight under my nose, look in the yard, and I zeroed in on spider eyes, and then I could walk up and actually see the spider in the grass. Will that happen with spiders in Wisconsin? I've been a camp counselor. I've never heard of this trick. It absolutely blew my mind.
Yes, so that will indeed work. It turns out with spiders, just with the structure and anatomy of their eye, you can shine a light at it, and you can see back to me when I see it. It almost has a hint of blue and maybe orange, too. But that's certainly the case here in Wisconsin. That can be a way to help you spot them. I also remember years and years ago, I had done a short-term study abroad down in Belize, and I remember our guide taking us out in the rainforest at night and doing this exact same thing. You can do that. And it was just amazing how many spiders were out there.
Really interesting. Kate, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Diane emailed us, could you comment, PJ, on foliar fungicide sprays and their effect on pollinators? Diane would like to spray her crab apples for apple scab and nine barks for powdery mildew, but she doesn't want to hurt the pollinators.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And I actually have a colleague in our entomology department, Dr. Sean Stefan, who has done some work on this. So in general, most fungicides tend to not have direct acute toxicity to bees and other pollinators. So it means if you were spraying and they contact it, it's probably not acutely toxic. But what we are learning is that in some cases, you can have these sublethal effects. And in other cases, it can have some very, very subtle effects. And my colleague, Sean Stefan, that I mentioned, he has done some research that looked at bumblebees. And it turns out bumblebees collect pollen and nectar to feed to young. And when that is in a bumblebee nest, there's actually a microbial component, yeast, that grow on that and can help preserve it. And the fungicides can affect the yeast. And so we are learning that there may be these very subtle impacts of bees and other pollinators picking up some fungicides and it basically affecting the microbes that live in their gut. And we don't know exactly what that means. So there's also differences. There's a lot of different types of fungicides. So without knowing exactly what you're spraying, I can't give you any really specific guidance on that.
Yeah. And there are different sprays for nine bark that you could use or for others as well. So it's you do need to have the specific.
Yeah. And there are some websites out there where you can go online and search for a given name of the active ingredient in a pesticide product, and it can give you some background information in terms of potential impacts to bees and other pollinators.
You can join in, too. Number to call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. It's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email your question or photo. We haven't gotten a photo yet, but we probably will, to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Talking insects today on the program with our guest, P.J. Leash, who heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him back, and certainly questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. Paula in Whitewater emailed us, you said our Janesville and the North Shore of Lake Geneva are hot spots. What about the whole area in between Lake Geneva and Janesville? And how long will the soil stay aerated?
Yeah, so in terms of the distribution, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, but these periodical cicadas, they're really not broadly distributed widely across southern Wisconsin. They only occur in the southern part of the state, but I really think of their distribution is like pins on a map. So put a pin on, on Lake Geneva area. Put a pin on Janesville and just northwest of there and Beloit. But in between, it's unlikely to bump into them. Now, perhaps there's some little localized populations that haven't been documented before. I've got a project. I'm trying to get a better feel for that in the state. But one thing I want to point out is with the isolated nature of these, most Wisconsinites are not actually going to have these in their yard or in their neighborhood.
So tell us about that project that you've got going and how people might get involved in it.
Sure. So recently I launched a new periodical cicada website for Wisconsin. It's got an easy web address. It's cicadas.wisc for Wisconsin, .edu for education. So cicadas.wisc.edu. And on that site, there's a whole bunch of really cool, fun information. Basically everything you'd ever want to know about periodical cicadas and this year's emergence, like when and where you can find them, including a detailed map. But then there's an item on the menu bar that says share your sightings. And it's an easy form where you just enter a few pieces of information. You can upload photos. That helps me verify that we did indeed confirm periodical cicadas were in a given spot. And then you can submit, and it'll send it off into a database. And I'm trying this so that we can get a better idea of where these insects occur in the state. Historically, a lot of the records were mentioned in a newspaper column here or there or scatter reports, and there's no single concise source of these. So that's what I'm trying to do this year with that website.
Amy emailed us. They live in the city of Milwaukee near Mount Mary University, have for 25 years, and they've seen cicadas every year since they lived there. At least 15 every year. They not only see them, but they hear them pretty often. As a matter of fact, that our neighbor had guests who had never experienced them, and one of the guests thought he was hearing things in his own head until he sheepishly asked, "Is it just me hearing that buzzing sound, or do you hear it too?" They laughed and kind of felt bad for him at the same time. They love their sound. It's the sound of summer.
Oh, certainly. And I love that sound too. I mean, I have very fond memories of being a kid playing outdoors just with the dog day cicadas buzzing in the background, kind of that constant song. When you see cicadas like that every year, those would be some of our what we call annual cicadas because they pop out on an annual basis. So that's a little bit different than what we're going to be seeing this year. And also those dog day cicadas that we can see every year, they are out in July, August, September, the hot dog days of summers. This year, what we're talking about with the big emergence, those are periodical cicadas. And so those only come out every 17 years, and they don't just come out in single digits or dozens in your yard. If they are present in your area, they're going to be out by the hundreds of thousands or millions. So tremendous numbers. There's a lot of different types. But I will say, if you really love the sound of that, there's a cool website online called songsofinsects.com. And they have a guide on that page where you can listen to a whole bunch of different audio recordings for various insect species. And, you know, if you're having the blues in January, February, and you want to listen to that and make you think of summer, close your eyes a little bit, I think that's a great thing.
Man, I have Jeff. We'll get Jeff to give us some more cicada sounds here in a minute or two. Diane in Madison, by the way, mentions, hey, this is also, she heard, this 13-year cicadas are coming too, are emerging in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Well, the 13-year cicadas are emerging in the U.S., but we don't get those here in Wisconsin.
Okay.
So in general, we've got all these periodical cicadas. They're sorted into groups we call broods. So Wisconsin, we will see brood 13, that's Roman numeral 13, but brood 13 are 17-year cicadas. There's also
okay.
brood 19, which is emerging this year. Those are 13-year cicadas. But
okay.
we've got three total broods of 13-year cicadas. They're all distributed in the southern U.S. So the 13-year cicadas, they make it as far north as about mid-Illinois, so we won't have those here. We'll only have the 17-year cicadas in the state.
Jerry in Amherst, your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Jerry, are you there? Oh, we must have lost Jerry. Let's go to Perry in Oconto. Hi, Perry.
Yes, PJ, can you tell me about the Herophilus acalasticus spider?
Oh, I'm not familiar with that particular scientific name. Do you know a common name for that species?
Parsons?
Oh, Parsons spider, yes, yes. So those can be very common. I actually see them in my own house fairly regularly. They are kind of a decent size species, blackish, and they have a very distinctive kind of white band or pattern on the body. It reminds folks of a parson or clergy person with the whitish collar. That's why it gets that name. Those are common. They're harmless. That's one of the species that is actually fairly well adapted for indoor conditions. And as a whole, we probably have somewhere in the ballpark of about 500 spider species in Wisconsin, we think. And there's maybe, 25 or so, I'd say, that are really pretty well adapted for indoor conditions because it's too dry. Most other spiders, they might sneak in accidentally, but they couldn't survive long term. And it seems like that Parsons spider can do a decent job of living indoors.
Yeah, there you go, Perry. Thank you for calling. Stephen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, I got a question. We moved from Milwaukee a couple of years ago, come to Madison, we got stink bugs. How do we get rid of them?
And are these in your house?
Oh, yeah, they come in. They get everywhere.
Okay.
You know, they you know, seem to hibernate over winter, and then spring they'll be out in our house again, and they're outside too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're not alone. This is a particular species of stink bug called the brown marmorated stink bug, and it's a non-native invasive species originally from parts of Asia. It's been in the state now for over a decade. The first few years that it was here, we would just find isolated reports here. There are not many of them. But over the last probably 7 or 8 years, it's really become pretty abundant in some parts of the state. And I would say for Madison and Dane County, we happen to be one of the hot spots. So a lot of activity from this insect. In terms of their behavior in the fall and winter, it's really the same kind of story as box elder bugs. These are insects that are looking for shelter in the fall. Out in nature, they would get under the loose bark of a dead tree or in a log or rock pile or something like that. But they can sneak in through gaps and cracks, edges of siding, soffit areas, cracks in foundation. From their point of view, they're really trying to get in. They would want to hunker down and leave again in the spring. But if they get into a location such as a wall void and they are warm enough during the winter, they can become active indoors during the winter months and be a nuisance. They're not going to hurt anything indoors or reproduce, but they can be a nuisance. And if you squish them, they smell. Indoors at this point, the best bet is to simply vacuum them up with a hose attachment of the vacuum cleaner or sweep them up and chuck them outside. Looking at the bigger picture, though, what can be really helpful is to look at the outside of your home and try and seal it up better so that they can't get in and fall. If you're in a newer home, things usually seal up well. If you're in like a 100-year-old farmhouse, that can be tough, I will admit. Another option, if you just can't seal things up with caulk or expanding insulation foam or other means, either you can do this or you can hire a company to spray. You're not spraying the entire side of your house. You spray little strips around doors and windows and the soffit area where they're trying to get in. And the products that you can use, they have repellent properties. You can get them at the hardware store for spraying box elder bugs and other things. And that can help keep them out. If we prevent them from getting indoors in the fall, you won't have them being a nuisance during the winter or early spring months again.
Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, it's your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a question about two different kinds of what I believe are poisonous spiders. So this past Saturday, my adult son was bitten by a brown recluse spider while working on a vehicle in Oklahoma. So I'm wondering what your advice is about that. And then I'm also wondering, as people travel so much, do we have brown recluse, or could we have brown recluse in Wisconsin? And also, are you familiar with a white spider? I think it's called a voodoo spider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's start with the second part first. I don't think I've heard of a voodoo spider before, so I don't think I can really comment
white
on
one.
That.
Yeah.
Regarding the brown recluse spiders, though, we really don't have them here in Wisconsin, although there's a lot of kind of urban myths and misunderstandings, and so folks think we have them, and we really don't. I am aware of a few, you know, small number of situations where someone has maybe moved up to Wisconsin from the native habitat of this particular spider, Oklahoma, parts of Arkansas, and southern Missouri and things like that. And if you had them in your box of books and you moved up here, could you get them into a house? That could happen in theory, but it's really, really rare for that to happen. Otherwise, if you wanted to find brown recluse spiders, you got to drive south of us to southern Missouri, Arkansas, places like that, Oklahoma, of course. With bites and suspected bites, there's also been some challenges with the medical community and in some situations, kind of overdiagnosing irritation and skin as brown recluse spider bites when it might have other causes and just presents. It's kind of like a necrotic type wound. There's been some research. One study looked at a family, I believe it was in Kansas, that just had thousands of brown recluse spiders in their house for about 5 years or so. They followed them. No one was ever bitten. So we know they really don't like to bite. Could they bite defensively? That's possible. But also, we know from verified bites that about 95 or 90% of the bites, it tends to just be a very localized reaction, maybe similar to bee sting. 10% can have this necrotic state. But again, that is something that can potentially happen, especially it's going to be more feasible in Oklahoma than in a location like Wisconsin, where we really don't have these. And my general advice on that is work with the medical professionals to deal with any symptoms associated with it.
Yeah, that makes the most sense. Christina, thank you so much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he is going to be with us right up until 12:30. And we'll take your calls. You can join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with PJ. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking cicadas and other insects on the program today with our guest PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Appreciate it. If you have a cicada or another kind of insect question, I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Cindy emailed us. They noticed a butterfly in the Green Bay area. It had a coloring similar to a monarch, however, more yellow-orange and less black-brown in it. It was slightly smaller than a monarch. They don't think it was a painted lady. The butterfly moved faster than they could snap a photo. What type might they be? And when do the monarchs come back?
Yeah, so I was chatting with a colleague who's involved with the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, and apparently there's been one report of a monarch sighted in the state thus far. We're still pretty early, though. Again, when they come from Mexico, they make it to about Texas, and then additional generations make it up here. So over the next month, month and a half, we're going to see a lot more monarchs. It's been interesting, though. The last week, week and a half, I've been seeing a lot of butterfly activity out there, and there are some other migratory species in addition to monarchs. So there's one common one called the Red Admiral, and I've just seen dozens and dozens of them around town. Yes. Hard to miss. I have also had some activity of painted ladies and possibly American ladies as well. And anytime you get weather patterns that are just right for moving some insects up from more southern areas, you can get some additional species as well. But at the moment, without seeing a picture, it's hard to tell exactly what that might be. But we have had lots and lots of reports coming in the last week and a half of both red admirals, painted ladies, and possibly American ladies as well.
Mike in eastern Wisconsin, we go to you now. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. A few months ago, I heard that there was a problem in Paris with bed bugs, and they were having the Olympics this summer. They were trying to resolve that. There are some bed bug issues in Wisconsin. What are the best treatments to avoid or kill these insects?
Yeah, great question. Bed bugs in general, they can be very challenging to deal with. And anytime I get a sample at the diagnostic lab and I confirm it as bed bugs, my next recommendation is to work with a pest management professional. And the reason I say that is if you or I go to the hardware store, we can find some sprays that will even maybe show a picture of a bed bug on there. And sure, if you had a container and you put a bed bug in there and sprayed it and sealed it up, it's probably going to kill that insect. But those sorts of products tend to struggle in the real world. And there's plenty of situations where if you try to control them yourself, you can make the situation worse. You have to be really thorough. You have to have the right product. Sometimes it may be liquid sprays. Sometimes it's dust or powder type formulations that can be powdered behind baseboards and outlet cover plates and things like that. And so I've seen where do-it-yourself efforts have made the situation worse, because instead of bed bugs being in one room, you can repel them and you have them popping up throughout a house. And that really makes it a lot harder to deal with. So the best option is to work with a pest management professional. They do have effective treatments. There's challenges with some resistance to insecticides. Luckily, they have a number of different classes of insecticides they can use. But again, you have to apply it thoroughly in the right amounts, in the right spots. That often takes some knowledge and education and training. There are also heat treatments. Sometimes clients just might not want to go the chemical route, or maybe they have sensitivities or allergies, or they prefer the heat route. Pest control professionals can bring in, they're basically really large space heaters. Bed bugs will die around 115 or so degrees Fahrenheit. And so they'll bring in these heaters, they'll get the temperature up to about 130, 140 in that range, and they have to hold that high temperature to allow the heat to permeate into wall voids where they might be hiding. So this is kind of an all-day process. It's going to take maybe about 8-ish hours thereabouts. Now, that can be very effective. One caveat of the heat treatments is there's no residual protection. So if there were one female stowaway that had eggs and all the others were killed off, she could repopulate. With the insecticide treatments, there's going to be some residual activity. So that's my best advice. If you do have bed bugs, or if you're suspicious, you see something you're not sure, you can always send in a sample to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. But if you confirm that you have bed bugs, it's best to work with a pest management professional.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much. John in Whitewater, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, Larry. I was wondering, I'd like to ask your guest about I was wondering if the larger cicadas down in Arkansas, I've heard them, they have a deeper, you know, voice than the high ones.
Yeah.
That we have down here. And I was just wondering if you've heard any reports that they're starting to move this way, because I swear to God I've heard them down here now.
Yeah, really interesting question. And I know my predecessor, Phil Pelletieri, would often joke that sometimes the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us, because over time, with climate change, milder winters, earlier starts to spring, longer falls, we are seeing insects start to push their way farther north and expand their ranges in some cases. Now, I haven't specifically heard that with any cicadas that we don't have here that are maybe to the south of us. It could occur over time. Again, I just haven't specifically heard it. I will also say, though, that there's a lot of insects that can make noise and produce sound. I talked about that website earlier called songsofinsects.com, and they've got a thumbnail page where you can view pictures of these insects and listen to different clips. And so it might be worth a little bit of time just listening to those and seeing, and you could tell, are you listening to a cicada sound or was it something that sounds similar? But again, I haven't heard any specific reports of cicadas moving up from, say, Arkansas, Missouri to Wisconsin at this point.
John, thank you for calling. Dan in Lake Delton. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We live in 6 acres. Our house is on 6 acres of very heavily wooded oaks, cherries, aspen, and pine trees. Last year, we used a trap for spongy moths, which was a pheromone trap with water in the bottom, and we caught lots of them. This spring, we've been chasing hundreds of egg masses on trees. My question is, what is likely to be the end result of this, obviously, this pretty serious infestation? And are we really making a dent in it with all the different methods that we're trying?
Yeah, tough situation that you're facing there, just with the number of acres and trees involved. When I look at the bigger picture with spongy moth, what is really going to make or break things for us this year, I feel, is going to be some of the weather patterns. I've been pleased with the rain we've been getting thus far. You know, we just had some pretty good showers come through the state last night and got some good rainfall from that. One thing that has really helped spongy moth the last few years has been the dry conditions. They thrive under dry conditions. There's a beneficial fungal disease called Entomophaga myemiga, which if we have a rainy spring, will help kill the populations. It infects the caterpillars. Their populations can crash. So historically, looking back at, say, the last 10 to 15 years, when we have rainy years, spongy moth populations tend to be kept in check. But we've now had a couple of consecutive dry years, so their populations have built up. What's probably going to make the biggest difference for you and your property, if we have a rainy spring and those caterpillars start getting sick with this fungus, the fungus can infect them, kill them within about a week, release more spores to the environment, and infect others. So hope for rain this spring. In terms of what you've been doing, you know, egg mass scraping can be a valuable approach, but if you have a really large area, I don't know how much that's really going to be doing for you. And also, you can only scrape the ones that you can reach. So if there's egg masses 30 feet up on a branch, I really don't want anyone climbing up that high to do that on a ladder. And so you have to be realistic about that. If you are removing an egg mass, that might be 500 to 1,000 eggs. But again, if there's plenty up above that you can't reach, you could still have plenty of caterpillars. In terms of the pheromone trap, I actually wouldn't recommend that. When the pheromone traps are used, they're used by like the state government, for example. That's more for monitoring purposes to help look at the bigger picture. But the pheromone trap really isn't going to help control local populations of those.
Maybe even entice a few to join in.
Yeah, potentially. It's hard to tell. But again, one single trap isn't really going to help with that.
No.
Sometimes there's something similar where they'll use a pheromone applied as flakes or a gel. They'll apply it with like a caulk gun. And the idea with that is called mating disruption. If you put out enough of the pheromone that the males cannot find the females, then it might confuse them enough to work. But research has shown that really seems to work best when their populations are really low. Oh. And we're in the midst of an outbreak. So using that or using the pheromone traps probably isn't helping you at this point.
Dan, thank you for calling. Linda in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Okay. So I have an urban native garden, all designed for lots of asters and pollination. And I have had this infestation that's gotten bigger and bigger for the last three summers, and it's lacewing bugs at those teeny tiny little, they're very pretty, but they just scarify the top of the leaf, and then they lay brown sticky eggs underneath the leaves. And I have done so many different mitigation strategies that I've gone online, and I'm still just really baffled. They are actually starting to emerge right now, and so I'm out there, you know, picking them off, and I don't use any chemicals. So just wondered if there's anything you have come across or understand the life cycle of this so I can maybe disrupt their mating or,
And you don't want to use chemicals. Okay.
Yeah, well, a couple of thoughts here. So lace bugs, if listeners aren't familiar with them, they're generally related to aphids and stink bugs and leafhoppers. They've got sucking mouth parts. So what they do is they're not chewing holes in leaves. They suck fluid out, and that can cause this kind of discolored, speckled, yellowish appearance to leaves. They just kind of look off when you see them from a distance, and sometimes even get some rusty colors on the leaves. They can be fairly common on certain plants. I know like hawthorns can be an easy way to find them, but there are some species. There's a chrysanthemum lace bug, for example, that can go to some of our perennial flowers in the landscape. But one thing that stands out to me about lace bugs is that they seem to do well with hotter, drier conditions, which we've had the last couple of years. It's been drier than average, including last year, some pretty severe drought here and there at various points in the year. So I really think from what I've been seeing at my own diagnostic lab is with the dry conditions, I've been seeing this general uptick in reports of those. If we have a rainy year this year, that might help keep them in check just due to natural pathogens and diseases that can infect insects. So that may help you out. I know you mentioned not a spraying for these, but I do want to mention there are some relatively low-impact options that you might consider if you seem to have a really significant problem with these. One thing could be as simple as insecticidal soap.
Yeah.
It's something that dries very quickly. It only works by contact, so if you spray it and it's dry 5 minutes later, it's done. So the risk to bees are generally going to be minimal. An additional step you could do, though, because these lace bugs, they really don't leave the plants. You know, bees are foraging during the day, they go away at nighttime. And so you could go out and consider treating your plants after dark when those bees aren't active. One thing to keep in mind is that lace bugs are often on the undersides of the leaves. So just make sure to spray thoroughly, top sides and undersides, but that could be an option. And again, if you see a few, you could consider spraying with something like insecticidal soap, very low risk, and it's only going to harm insects that are directly contacted by it. So that could be something that you could try this year.
Good luck. Appreciate the call. Jackie in northern Wisconsin emailed us. They're struggling with Asian lady beetles. This is in northern Wisconsin. Will having a professional spraying done help? They have tried vacuuming, but it only works for 15 minutes. Is this going to go on, in all capital letters, forever?
Well, not forever, but as things get warmer, from the insects' point of view, these lady beetles would want to head outside because during the warmer months, they're actually beneficial predators of insects like aphids, so they can help you out in your yard and garden and farm fields and things like that. The story with these is, in fall, once it starts getting cool, they're looking for sheltered spots where they can overwinter. And so out in nature, they'd get under the loose bark of a dead tree and a rock pile or something like that. But we know from some research that homes can be particularly attractive to them. In their native range, places in China, these insects would overwinter in cracks and crevices, unlike cliff faces where the sun warms it up. Well, to an insect, when you see a house and you see these vertical lines from a siding and horizontal lines, that might look somewhat similar. And so it can draw them into houses. They just squeeze in through little nooks and crannies. So in terms of spraying can help. But when we look at the bigger picture, you would probably want to do that in like late summer, early fall to prevent them from getting in for the winter months. Another option is if you can look at the outside of your house, seal things up really well. If they can't get in, then they won't be a problem indoors. So that's an option too, using caulk or backer rod or expanding insulation foam. For spraying, you can either do it yourself with stuff from the hardware store, the home defense type products, or you could hire someone to do that. They're going to be using probably a pretty similar type of ingredient to do that. At the moment, indoors, I'd probably recommend staying the course, using the vacuum cleaner. They're really not doing well indoors because it's a little too dry for them. They're wandering aimlessly. They're burning up energy reserves. It's not good for them, for their survival. And so they're probably not going to survive very long in living quarters. So I'd probably continue to vacuum or sweep them up. Could you spray indoors? Yes, in theory, it might help decrease their numbers. But again, these things want to leave anyways to go outdoors this time of the year. So you're kind of just hastening their demise a little bit if you spray indoors.
Katie mailed us a photo, and they currently have an infestation of dozens of these bees in their woodpile. They think they're longhorn bees, but understand that those bees are solitary ground dwellers. So what the heck are they? They want to protect our native bees, but people have to walk past this woodpile constantly. It's a bad location for them. How can we encourage them to move?
Yeah, so looking at the picture, and from what I can see, the photo's a little small for me, but it really reminds me of some of our mason bees, which can be very common this time of the year. And mason bees are just, in my mind, they're cute little bees. They're like little teddy bears almost. They're really fuzzy. They are very docile creatures, and they're also solitary. So you might be seeing many coming and going from the same area, but each female essentially has her own nest. And with mason bees, they like to nest in tube-like habitats. So that could be a hollow plant stem, but in a pile of firewood, for example, if in the firewood there were pre-existing insect holes, maybe beetle larvae had been tunneling in a tree, it's dead, you cut it down, you make firewood. Insects like mason bees can take advantage and use that tube-like habitat to nest in. So I'm guessing there's probably pre-existing holes in the firewood. These beneficial solitary bees are just using that as a nesting habitat. They're really docile, unlikely to sting. One consideration you could do would be to, if it's possible, move that wood pile elsewhere. That's probably going to be your best bet, because we really wouldn't want to spray for something like this, because they're harmless and they're really beneficial, great pollinators.
Yeah, they're great pollinators. A listener from Madison couldn't stay with us. They work in a restaurant and have a terrible problem with fruit flies. What's the best way to get rid of them in a commercial setting?
Yeah, so commercial settings can be a little bit challenging. You know, a restaurant, you got patrons coming and going. In my mind, with fruit flies and a number of our other small indoor flies, a key thing is finding the food source that they're using to have their young develop on. For fruit flies, that could be just about any sort of damp organic material. So of course they have the name fruit flies. They love stuff like fermenting fruit. You probably don't have that just sitting around. But in restaurants, one thing that they can sometimes use would be a little bit of sticky residue left over in bottles from like a beer can or beer bottle, something like that. So really good sanitation, making sure those things are taken care of. But any food that is spilled, like under a bar, that could be a potential food source for these. In a kitchen food prep area, if you have food that was spilled on the floor and it, say, gets kicked against the leg of some table or stand or something like that, if that stays damp enough, that could be a food source. So doing some really thorough detective work, either yourself or working with a pest management professional who has experience doing this, that can be really helpful. Sometimes in food preparation environments, you have some other sources that might be at play, grease traps, floor drains, things like that, if there's a buildup of gunk in there. But again, your best bet often comes from tracking down and dealing with the source rather than focusing on spraying.
Jason in Madison emailed, loves your share your sightings approach for finding these periodic cicadas where they may be located. Are there other community science initiatives that folks can contribute to in the last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, so for cicadas, for example, there's actually a smartphone app called Cicada Safari. That's a national-wide citizen science project. The one that I'm focusing on here is just for Wisconsin. I know sometimes folks don't want to download an app to their phone, and so you can just pull up the website and upload reports right from a phone, tablet, or computer. So kind of different approaches for going about it.
And we have that up on our ideas at WPR.org/Larry page. But what's the address?
It's really easy. It's cicadas.wisc.edu.
I'll tell you what, PJ, it was fun having you here in person, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Yeah, it's been great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
PJ Leash, our guest manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back, and we will have him back again. Tomorrow, we'll talk about what you need to know about advanced care directives and planning for your future health needs, and information on how to sign up for Medicare. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.